And today I am with a very special guest. It's Ave Pildes. He is a photographer in Los Angeles. He is originally from Cincinnati, Ohio. And in his early days, he was a stringer for Downbeat Magazine in the Ohio Valley in the Pennsylvania area. That's my stomping grounds, where I'm from. So that's good. Ave is the first person from the state of Ohio that we've talked to on the Street Photography Magazine. Sorry, I almost lost my place there. So, Ave, welcome. Thanks for being with us today.
Well, it's good to be here, and I'm glad to be talking to a fellow Buckeye, which is a term of endearment, I think. And I think that Ohio is a really good place to be from. So, you know, there's a good roots there, and I'm happy that the people of Ohio have pretty good values, except for those people who have been there too long.
I meant
way back to probably the 18th century. You know, they still have some attitudes that get people who want to explore the rest of the world an opportunity to leave Ohio. So I'm glad to be from Ohio. I had a great education there, a wonderful childhood, and I feel good about having lived other places in the world, and I'm happy to be in California now. I don't miss the Ohio winters. You know, I think it's great when you're a kid and you can get off of school, but, you know, as soon as you have to start showing up at work and getting through the snow, that's where I draw the line. So, not anything other than that about Ohio. I had great times there. Took a lot of good pictures there. So, happy to be from there and happy to be moving on.
Yeah, I can't blame you. We just came out of like one of the worst winters we've had in ages, and glad to see it behind us. Ave, I wonder if you could tell us a little bit about yourself. You are from Ohio. Tell us a little about your background. You've done a lot of really cool things over the years, and I'm sure everybody wants to know more about what you've been up to.
Well, I can start by saying that I'm an old fart now, although I don't feel old. But, you know, when I tell people that I was born in the 30s, they say, no, that's not possible, because most people that I know don't remember the 30s at all. And quite frankly, I don't remember them either. I was born in 1939. My early education in Ohio was that I went to the University of Cincinnati and studied architecture, and found it really too confining, because, you know, Ohio is a really a conservative place, and Cincinnati was conservative, and the kind of architecture that I wanted to do wasn't conservative. So I had a little falling out there with the program, and switched over to a design program that was much more open, and I could really be more experimental. At the time that I was going to design school, I was also an art director at the Cincinnati Public Library, and that was a really terrific experience, because I got to hang out in the stacks, and you know, I was designing things for the library, you know, like placards and exhibits and things like that, but most of the time, whenever I had a chance, I was in the stacks looking at photo books. So, you know, my first education in photography was really, you know, like looking at really traditional French photographers and old photographers. And then I discovered Aaron Siskin, who was also, you know, from Chicago area. And I just thought his pictures were incredible. They were mostly of still things and abstract things, and that really resonated with me. And so for a long time, I thought those images that he made were just incredible. And I think the early pictures that I took, and I didn't really have a photography course until later on in my education, but those early pictures that I took were were things of inanimate objects, things that I found in alleys and you know, walking around Cincinnati, statues. I remember that the Cincinnati Inquirer, I think, published a series of pictures that I took when I was quite young of fire plugs, the different fire plugs that they had in and around Cincinnati. And that was really, you know, off the beaten track for them. But the fire plugs looked a lot like people. They had different personalities, and there were a lot of them. So that was really maybe the first published thing that I had. And that really set me on the path to continue to take pictures, although I wasn't a photography student in a college or university, or my photography education was really on my own. I continued to have a really good relationship with the newspaper there, and they published a couple of other things, a story on a bridge that went across the Ohio River, that was a steel bridge that had lots of decoration and ironwork on it. That bridge is since gone; they tore it down. But I noticed that a bridge, because I used to cross it over to Newport, Kentucky. Where underage kids, although at the time I wasn't underage, but when I was underage, I used to cross over there to buy beer. And naturally, that city, Newport, was a wide open city, so you could buy almost anything you want. I think that you could probably trade whooping cough for diphtheria if you wanted to. So it was just, you know, attached to Cincinnati, but in another state. So there were a lot of myself and my teenage buddies who went over there to get in trouble not as often as we could, but, you know, like whenever we got bored with Cincinnati, we'd go to Kentucky. And back to my education, I think that when I got out of school, college in the early 60s, I took the first train east and landed in Pittsburgh. Let me digress a little bit. That while I was still in Cincinnati, I also might add, if I go back a little bit, that, you know, when I was growing up, my mother, who was creative, you know, kind of twisted my arm to play a musical instrument. The first one was a violin. I didn't like that at all because I was more interested in baseball. So it was a real challenge to get me to practice a violin, and especially since my baseball buddies and my football buddies would always think of violin as a sissy instrument. So I wasn't really, you know, like wanting to do that. However, in high school, that when I wasn't playing sports, I was a band member, and I was playing a B flat trumpet. Wasn't very good, but I was playing a B flat trumpet. Then during that time, I was also really interested in jazz, so I started going to jazz clubs because I really liked the music. And I started taking pictures. It was really kind of the first people pictures I took were in the clubs around Cincinnati, and they were, you know, the clubs there were, you know, like really dark places. They didn't have good lights, so it was a real challenge to take pictures there. I was using a Pentax camera at the time, and I was rating my Tri-X film at I don't know, way up there, you know, like 2400 or even higher, and using a two-stage developer, you know, like either I think it was a developer called Diafine at that time, and which allowed me to get some image on the film, and when they when the performers did get into the light, then I got decent, well, I wouldn't say decent, but I did get imagery. the one of the problems with pushing your film like that is that, you know, aside from it being grainy, you know, it got contrasty, which in a way worked to my favor, because all of those pictures that I took of musicians don't really have any backgrounds to them. They're all kind of black backgrounds, and the light is just on the musicians. So that became a style without even me knowing that it was a style. So I took a few pictures there, and people said, "Hey, that's a good, those are good pictures. Why don't you send them to Downbeat?" So I sent them off to Downbeat, and Downbeat said, "Hey, these are good pictures. Would you like to be a stringer?" I didn't even know what stringer was, but I said yes, and that meant that they gave me a little card that said that you know, I was from Downbeat. That got me into the clubs for free, and was an entree to the musicians. And then if they used a picture, they'd give me $10. Or if you know, if occasionally I got a cover picture, and it happened two or three times, that they'd give me $25, or maybe it was $20. But I was thrilled, and it wasn't about the money. I was just saying, "Wow, this is incredible." When I moved to Pittsburgh, you know, I moved there to take a job in a studio to do design work for big corporations like U.S. Steel and Westinghouse and Alcoa Aluminum and Coppers and you know, it was industrial graphic design, doing catalogs and things like that. And it was good design, but it was boring, you know. And I continued to take pictures in jazz clubs in Pittsburgh, and made a lot of musician friends in Pittsburgh, and also made a friend of Eric Kloss and his father, who was a doctor and head of the Pennsylvania School for the Blind, because Eric Kloss was a blind tenor saxophone player. And at the time, he knew how interested I was in jazz, and he said, "Hey, how come you don't learn to play the saxophone?" So I bought an alto saxophone, and I was living in a fourth floor walk up in Pittsburgh in a place called Shadyside, and I started playing the alto saxophone, practicing scales for 3 hours a day. And, you know, I, you know, got pretty good in C jam blues. But I wasn't a very good saxophone player, as I wasn't a very good trumpet player, and I wasn't a very good violin player. So, after practicing for hours and realizing that I was never going to be as good as all these guys who I really, thought were incredible, musicians, I decided that I would bite the bullet and just be a good designer and good photographer. So I kind of gave up on the saxophone. It was a great experience. I think I forgot to mention that Eric, because Eric was a teenager at the time and couldn't drive, and I was working and couldn't get over to his place all of the time, that he often tutored me on the saxophone over the telephone. So it was a really wonderful experience, and I enjoyed it, and I had a good time in Pittsburgh. I was there maybe 2.5 years, and saved my money while I was there. And I had a really good mentor in Cincinnati, Ohio, who was a director of, I guess, publication at the Cincinnati Art Museum, and a well-known typographer named Noel Martin, who had always said, "You know, you should go to a graduate school in Switzerland. There's a really good guy there that I know." And so after I had saved a bunch of money in Pittsburgh, I just quit my job and went to Switzerland and went to graduate school for 2.5 years in Switzerland, studying more design and typography. During all this time, I was still taking pictures, but that wasn't my focus. You know, my focus was design. When I left, and I took a lot of travel pictures when I was in Europe, but not the kind of pictures that I'm taking now. Even though, interestingly enough, some of the travel pictures that I took were published. There was an agency in New York called Chastel who used some of my travel pictures because I had a good design sense. And Bob, am I rambling on too much?
No, keep going, keep going.
Yeah, I had the opportunity to drive through Russia, and I wound up on an island in the north of Russia at a church that nobody had seen since the 15th century, and took some pictures of that. I had to. Because I was interested in architecture and design, I wound up there in tourist, took me, you know, they put me on a train under guard and took me off the train under guard and put me on a hydrofoil, got me out to this island. And I was a student. I was there just as a student. And I took these pictures, and then those pictures were published by a really good a photo magazine in Switzerland called DU, and nobody had seen that church in years, and then Camera magazine wanted them. Subsequently, they published something else, but it just sort of, you know, kind of by serendipity, I kind of got into photography as a parallel vocation to my design. When I left Switzerland, I was hired as a professor right out of school in Milwaukee, which was even colder than Cincinnati. And I didn't last there very long, one year, because I was too liberal for them. But I had a chance to meet Walter Scheffer, who was a photography teacher and mentor. And along with Danny Lyon, I met him a couple times because he was from Milwaukee area, although I can't say that I became really friendly with him. But he was also an influence on me, you know, to take a different kind of picture. And then when I left Milwaukee, I went to Philadelphia to be a professor of design. And that's when I really started paying more attention to photography, even though I was a design instructor. And one of the reason was that Ray Metzger was at Philadelphia at the same time I was, and I just became enamored of his style and his photography. And he was a street photographer. I mean, an early one. I mean, there were other ones who were early street photographers and my heroes, because I was always looking at photo books. But you know, he was also his pictures were. He pushed the boundaries of what street photography is considered to be now, and he was also a very good designer, you know. So I kind of paid attention to his pictures, although even at that time, that's not what my pictures were about. They were still about music and travel and using photography in my design work. So. I didn't stay in Philadelphia very long, 3 years. And then during a Christmas break, I went to visit a friend in California, in Los Angeles, with my wife and kid. We drove out here, and there was a job open at Capitol Records. You know, somebody told me I should talk to Capitol Records, and I went over and talked to them, and they said, well, do you have any work with you? And I said, no, it's all in Philadelphia. And they said, well, when you get back to Philadelphia, give us a call and we'll send you a ticket to come out here and show us your work. So I drove back across the country. And when I got back to Philadelphia, I called them up and I said, well, I'm back. And they said, OK, get on a plane and come on out here. And I did, and I showed them my portfolio. And they said, well, do you want a job? So I wound up, you know, they bought out my contract from the school. I left in mid-year, not mid, but in the semester break. and became an art director at Capitol Records. 2 weeks after I arrived at Capitol Records, the Beatles broke up, and that was Capitol Records' bread and butter. And the company went crazy. They didn't know what to do. They had one floor was fighting with everybody was trying to grab for power. And, you know, so the company was in complete disarray. So, you know, I said, wow, this is crazy. So I was maybe at Capitol Records, maybe 6 months. And I just said, this isn't for me. So I left and started my own little design company. And when I couldn't get the kind of pictures that I wanted, I just became a photographer and then just transitioned over from design to photography, basically because it was a much cleaner profession. I could bill my clients for half of the money in advance when I was taking pictures, which I couldn't do as a designer. You know, I often had to carry the clients for months and months before I got paid, if I got paid. And then as a photographer, it was just I only had my jobs maybe were 2 weeks at a time. If that would be a long shoot. You know, if I had to work 2 weeks for one client, occasionally it might be longer, but mostly they were a couple days shoot and it was over and then you'd go on to the next one. And while I was in Los Angeles, I noticed the landscape in Los Angeles, and that was all really completely different for me. And I started taking pictures of really architecture, you know, the mostly Art Deco architecture, because I was interested in that. You know, as a kid, there was a place in Cincinnati called, the Hotel Downtown that had a Caldera in it. And I used to go down and watch this 20 Leaves and an Apple mobile in this hotel. Maybe it was a Plaza, Netherland Plaza Hotel. That's what it was. And that was an Art Deco hotel. So I guess that influenced me. Started taking pictures of Art Deco architecture in Los Angeles. And all of a sudden, Harper and Row wanted me to do a little book on Art Deco architecture. So I did a little book. It was only 8 inches square, 64 pages of Art Deco architecture. And at the same time, I started noticing movie theaters and box offices in Los Angeles and started taking pictures of those. And then, you know, during that time, I started collecting pictures of movie theaters. Next thing I know, Crown wanted me to do a book on movie theaters across the country. So I bought a Volkswagen van and traveled around the country and took pictures of movie theaters. And that was kind of the beginning of my commercial photography career. During that time, I was also taking pictures on the street, you know, like on people standing on Hollywood Boulevard and just around Los Angeles, because everything was so crazy for me out here. And, you know, the people were crazy and the architecture was crazy. So I had a lot of shows of street photography, both in Los Angeles and in Europe, which happened to love this crazy Los Angeles stuff and Zoom and Italian photo magazines and a photo magazine, the original one from Paris. They all printed my pictures as California pictures and of street photography, but I couldn't sell any of them except to those magazines, which didn't pay very much. So, and when I had a number of shows, people wouldn't buy those pictures. So those kind of street photographs and the pictures that I really loved taking kind of got shifted to the background while people hired me to do commercial work. And the commercial work was architectural work, food photography, product photography, and I'm very thankful for that, and I'm glad that it afforded me a good living. And but it took away my time from the kind of pictures that I really like to take. And I can tell you that 2 years ago or 2.5 years ago, I destroyed all of the commercial work that I had done during the 80s.
Wow.
You know, I just threw it all out, cut it up and threw it in the dustbin. And it wasn't that the pictures weren't good. You know, they were good. They just didn't have much of me. I felt much of me in them. I mean, that's a weird thing to say because I took them, but took the pictures. But, you know, they were at the behest of other people. You know, mm-hmm. I had a job to do. You know, they were a client. You know, I had to make the food look good or I had to make the buildings look good. They were technologically oriented. You know, the lighting had to be right, you know, some of them had no life in them. And to tell you the truth, my feeling about it was that I didn't want to be responsible for those pictures anymore. So, you know, I didn't want to have to catalog them. I didn't want to have to keep track of them. I didn't want people asking me, hey, do you have this picture in your files? And so I just pitched them. And it was such a relief, you know, and it was, I guess maybe I was in the back of my mind, I was pissed off at those pictures because, you know, the kind of photography that I was really in love with, which was the search for something that or to really see what was happening in life, you know, like was kind of put in the background or overshadowed by me having to make a living, you know? So maybe down deep, I was just, you know, pissed off at those pictures. So I'm glad to have gotten rid of them. Now, it came back and bit me in the ass a few times, but now some of my dealers, when, you know, because some of my pictures now are being sought after and I'm selling those pictures that I couldn't sell from 30 or 40 years ago. When I mentioned to a dealer that I threw away all this commercial work, they say, oh, that's a shame. You could have sold it. And I just say, oh, that's Oops. Just really a dealer trying to make some money off of me, you know?
Yeah, that's true.
So I'm not sorry that I threw those away. You know, and I'm and on top of that, after a lot of years of teaching and taking pictures while I was teaching, but not pushing my work to be seen during that time, in 2008 when I retired from teaching, since then I've just been not only dealing with my archives and all of those pictures that were not seen while I was taking them. And since that time, taking as many pictures as I can, I just feel liberated, you know, and thrilled to be able to look at the pictures that I took, interact with other photographers, love other people's pictures, and to take more pictures. So that was the short story of my life. If we want to get into some specifics, we can do that now. But I won't tell you about all the failed love affairs that I had, and you know, like my bad marriages. But I'm in a really good marriage now, and have been with this woman for 20 years, and married 18. And I'm not saying that it is trouble free, but glad to be married to her. And she's a wonderful person and a fellow artist. And most of the time we get along just great.
Hey, let me ask you this. You've got your Hollywood Boulevard series, which I find pretty fascinating. And you've got a lot of photos that are taken in roughly the same place over a long period of time, over like maybe 20 some years, 30, maybe 30 years. But you've got all these photos of people on the walk. What's that called? All the stars on it.
The Walk of Fame.
The Walk of Fame. And I mean, did you purposely shoot these for like a long term project, or it's just because you happened to be there over the years and you just took a lot of photos and then put them together in this series?
Well, the black and white, until recently, the black and white pictures initially were shot in the 70s over about a 3-year period. And that was just a great place because there was a lot of foot traffic. It was on the turn, so part of it was derelict. It was in a time when people would still want to react to the camera, both positively and negatively. But there was an interaction between myself and the people I was taking pictures of. Sometimes there was no interaction, but it's very unlike today when there are so many people taking pictures that people don't want to have their pictures taken anymore. But in that time, I just loved being there. And I took pictures in two ways there. Some were handheld and some were on a tripod. And it's interesting. Interestingly enough, this is partly where, you know, I was trying to push past the boundary of just taking pictures that. Well, part of it is based on Bresson, you know, waiting around for something to happen. You know, so when I was looking at his pictures, you know, like I could tell, you know, like, oh, he's waiting, you know, the confluence of the way things happened in his pictures was, okay, he's waiting. He found a place that was interesting and he waited for something to happen. So based on that in the 70s, I said, okay, here's an interesting set. I think I'll set up here and wait for things to happen. So that's the way it started. So I set up at a place and I waited for things to happen. Now the pictures singularly, worked nice because that became a stage and you could see, you know, like the people were very outgoing or those people who posed for me. Those pictures that were more candid or that the people weren't reacting, it was just a good composition. And the pictures that you see naturally are edited from thousands of other pictures. But that also was the beginning of the pictures that I'm taking now, which are under paper movies. And we can wait a little bit for that. But it was that, you know, to try and push street photography a little bit further. And there are a few people who are shooting today, one of whom, you know, like Robin Rhode, I think that's the way you pronounce his last name. It's R-H-O-D-E or something like that. Maybe it's Rhodey or... where he draws something on a wall, and then you know, like a desk or a lemonade stand or something like that, and gets people to interact with that. So, I mean, that's not the type of picture I take, but I can appreciate that he's pushed street photography in that direction. So now to go back to your question about 30 years on Hollywood Boulevard, that's still a very vibrant place, although it's Hollywood Boulevard is and the Walk of Fame has become gentrified in a way because it's a tourist mecca. So, you know, it was kind of dormant there for a long time when it was really seedy. And now it's kind of mixed. You know, there's a lot of tourists there, especially around the Chinese Theater at the upper end of that. And although there was a homeless person who killed somebody there recently.
Yeah, I heard about that. Yeah.
Yeah. So it's a little bit, you know, I mean, you could still get in trouble there, but you know, generally it's patrolled by the cops and it's a neat place. And, I like it. And, you know, like Los Angeles really isn't a street place. You know, most people are in their cars. So recently, photographers in Los Angeles have been shooting in downtown Los Angeles because that's the place that's most urban and it's looking the most like a New York because it has some high rises or Chicago or places like that. But you know, downtown Los Angeles is overrun by street photographers now, and as is Hollywood Boulevard. But the other places around Los Angeles that are places where there are pedestrians, are Venice Oceanfront Walk, and besides downtown and Hollywood, maybe Pasadena and a few other places where there is foot traffic and a chance to interact with people. But those, you know, I just cherish those that time on Hollywood Boulevard from the 70s. And I've been back there recently and taken pictures, and probably will take some more pictures because I got a new camera recently that will allow me to, you know, like I'm just involved with a new camera. So a new Sony camera and that's smaller than my Canon equipment. You know, like it's again as small as the Pentax that I used to have. So I'm looking forward to using that in those kinds of situations again. The waiting around for people there allowed me to stand. You know, during the 70s, allowed me to stand there and just waving goodbye to my wife there. So she's off to teach a class today at USC. Allowed me to stand next to the camera, and when I saw. So the camera was set up on a tripod. And so if I saw somebody coming that I thought was an interesting character, way before they got to the camera, I'd be waving to them and talking to them and interacting them and say, oh, wow, you know, I really like your hat, or, you know, like, or maybe saying, gee, you got a funny walk, or whatever it was that came to my mind. And that would slow them down enough for me to say, hey, do you want to pose for a picture, or to stop and have a talk with me. And all the time, because I was on the end of a long cable release, you know, like I could be taking pictures, and they look very candid because the person didn't always know that I was taking the picture. So I just found that was a good way to work, and just loved it there. You know, it was just it really was a birth for me. You know, as a street photographer. So that, you know, I don't know. Did I answer the question, or yeah, did I scoot around it a lot?
No, I think you did both.
Oh, okay.
No, that's all right. You're talking about all the street photographers in Los Angeles. I talked to several over the last few months, and it seems like that there's a real growing community of people doing street photography out there. And I just wondered, do you get involved with those folks much, or are you out doing your own thing?
Well, I know a few of those people. You know, I wouldn't say I'm a solitary kind of a person. I think I'm better sometimes with strangers than I am with people that I know. You know, going out, I think that the photography, I've been out taking pictures with guys in groups and also taking classes out. But when I start taking pictures, I think that that's a very singular kind of thing. So I'm just involved with myself and the camera and the subject, and less involved with, you know, another person with me. I can give you some examples of that. If I'm teaching a class, I can't be taking pictures while I'm teaching a class of people to take pictures. I can be with them and help them and point out to them, what, you know, oh, try it from this angle, or, you know, like, wait for this to happen, or when I'm traveling with my wife, you know, it's not good for me to have to take pictures while she's waiting for me to take the pictures. So I'm not really hanging around with the other photographers in Los Angeles, although I can tell you that I think that Greg Semenko is an incredible photographer from out here. You know, he really has a lot of patience in taking pictures. He sees so much. He's shooting in black and white. And he has a great sense of humor, you know, and I found out recently that when he's not taking pictures, he's a stand-up comic. So That sort of counts for the fact that he's seeing all these wonderful, the humor in the pictures that he takes. Hmm. And then I think that Luis Cinco, who is an LA Times photographer, who's also won a Pulitzer. You know, I mean, he's a news photographer, but he's also a really good street photographer, and most of his pictures are on the street. And I've had the opportunity to walk around with him recently and have some meals with him recently. He's really a good guy. And then there's a guy who owns the Perfect Exposure Gallery, and his name is Armando Arizo. And he's a really good photographer, too. And I think David Valera, who is I've known for, you know, most of his life, and didn't even know that he was a photographer until recently, you know, over the last year. In fact, we lived on the same street together for years. And I was, you know, his father's age, but, you know, I used to go bicycle riding with him because I was an avid cyclist. And when he was a kid and didn't have a driver's license and had to get around on a bicycle, I used to go out and ride a 10-speed with him all the time, you know, just to stay in shape. And then I found out that he was, you know, had this wonderful education and working for Disney. But aside from him being wonderful, have a wonderful knowledge of technology, you know, because of his job at Disney, he's an excellent photographer. So he has a couple things going for him, you know.
He has
a really good eye, and on the technological side, he knows how to take pictures. So, you know, and then other street photographers from Los Angeles. There was Gary Kruger, and I don't know whether he's still taking pictures. And then that was a while ago. And then during the 70s, when I was taking pictures, Antonin Kratochvil, who is a really incredible photographer, was taking pictures at that time, and Ron Mazaros. And, you know, there's a long history of people taking pictures. And I'd say that I'm friendlier with guys my age than I am with younger, newer photographers. Not because I don't want to be friends with them. It's just that I haven't met them yet and I don't know them. I'm happy to be friends with them and share. I have never been proprietary around anything, you know. So I'd love to be more involved with the community. I think that I love when I see a good picture. I sometimes wish that, gee, I wish I would have taken that picture, but I'm not pissed off at the person who took the picture. I think, hey, good for them. What a great picture. So that's my take on that, you know.
Yeah, David, I talked to David Valera a few months ago, and, you know, I often ask people who their greatest influence was in their photography, and he named you. So
I didn't even know that, besides him sending me a little message maybe a couple months ago saying, oh, I did an interview and I gave you a shout out. And that's all I knew about it. But I didn't even have any idea that he had ever seen any of my pictures.
Oh, yes, so, he did.
And I mean, they've been around for a while, and I wasn't hiding them or anything. But so maybe it was that he saw them because he recognized the name, or he said, hey, that's my neighbor, or I went bicycle riding with that guy. But that's a very nice compliment, and I'm happy to get that compliment. And I recently saw him. We went to Paris Photo over the weekend together. I went there with just to say hello to people who look at my posts, because I post on Constant Contact, and there were a number of galleries and collectors in Europe that opened my pictures regularly, and I just went there to say, oh, thanks for looking at my pictures, please continue to do so. I wasn't going there to say, hey, buy my pictures. And so I went with David, and while I did that, he was out there taking pictures, and he took a lot of good pictures at Paris Photo too. And I went back the next day, and I think I got two good pictures with a little Sony with a little Canon A100, one that is a lot like a Ralph Gibson picture that I might post this week. So David's I can only say good things about David, and I'm glad that he says good things about me. So,
yeah, he sure did. He told me about your jazz series. So I went to your website, and just love them, especially your photo of Coltrane and the one of Thelonious Monk. And that's some great stuff you did back then.
The I think that I was very lucky, as I said in the beginning. I always try and figure out a way to use the equipment that I have. So you know, these musicians were always moving with the music and moving around, so it was really hard. Those pictures were taken with an 80 millimeter Schneider lens. That I adapted to a Pentax, and it was very fast, 2.0. I wish I still had that lens, and so it was a narrow field of focus. But I would pre-focus and wait for the musician to come into focus before I took the picture. I wasn't really following them. I was concentrating on holding the camera as still as I could, and when the looking through the viewfinder. And when the musician came into focus, I took the picture. A lot of the pictures I took are not in focus, but the ones that are that are in focus are good ones. And that series of pictures is interesting because you know, they were used when I first took them, and then they were dormant for 50 years. And I can tell you that. Because I did not know how, I guess, the rules of photography and how careful you have to be with negatives, that those negatives got moved around for years and years, and they aren't in the best of shape now. And I've since, you know, like scanned them or had them drum scanned and then cleaned them up in Photoshop, which I could never do if I was printing them traditionally, you know, making silver prints. I couldn't get as good a picture as I get nowadays, scanning them and making digital prints. And in fact, I just recently finished a box set of prints. So I have this box and it's cloth bound, and you know, it's 10 jazz greats, and each picture comes in this little folio.
Too bad this is an audio interview. If you've got a couple of photos of that, I'll put them on. We'll put them in the article. But that is a really cool looking box.
I can send you a picture of the box, but it's really pretty interesting that now one of my dealers and a couple other people have said, oh gee, this is great. How come these are digital prints? Well, I don't care whether they're digital prints or silver gelatin prints, because for me it's always been about the image and not about, you know, what the kind of print it is, you know? So, but because of that, now I've had to take my digital files back to a lab and have negs made of them so that I can make silver gelatin prints just to satisfy some people.
I hope it's worth it.
Well, I'm trying that. I have no idea whether I'll sell any of these. You know, the undertaking is, it's interesting that this undertaking is expensive because there's, it's in, you know, It involves, you know, like other people to build the boxes and buying the paper and making the prints and getting people to handle the work or trying to sell them for me. But fortunately enough, I don't care about the money, and I mean I'd like to be rewarded, but I think that the reward is in the fact that more people will see them, and not because I sell a picture, you know.
Yeah.
And I'm happy about that. I hope that a lot of people buy them, but not because it's going to give me money, but because the more people who have them, the more people who see them.
Yeah, well, that makes sense. I mean, yeah, you don't do this to keep it in a box somewhere.
No.
You want people to see it.
No, not at all.
Let's take a look at what you're doing now. You were talking about paper movies, and that's a very, very interesting project you're working on.
Yeah, it is, and you know, actually, more people are interested in the old stuff than the new stuff. But that's really street photography. I've just pushed the boundaries a little bit on that, in that all of the pictures are taken in public spaces, and they're not always on the streets. Sometimes they're in museums or airports, but wherever there's a lot of foot traffic. And it started out where I was really interested in escalators and staircases and things, but it's gone beyond that now. I set up the camera and wait for things to happen in that. Now, when I was taking pictures on Hollywood Boulevard, those were more singular situations. These are then edited afterwards into some kind of a story. Sometimes it's humorous, you know, like for instance, in the one that says "Lips Kiss," which are people disappearing in back of a palm tree, but and reappearing on the other side of the palm tree, often as a different person. But in the background, there was a big poster that was on the front of the storefront for Shiseido Cosmetics. They were opening a store in a street where there's a lot of traffic, foot traffic. So I cut out the part where that poster is putting on makeup and stuff, just so it looks like the poster is kissing the palm tree. So that's why it's called Lips Kiss. So that really brings attention. The palm tree's in the center of the frame, so you can't miss it. And you have to kind of look closely to see that there are people who are walking into the palm tree and then walking out of the palm tree. So for me, that's kind of pushing the boundaries of the street photography and the fact that it's street photography, but I'm also, you know, acting as a writer and as a director of telling a story, something other than just taking a single photograph. So they aren't all humorous. Sometimes, you know, like in a picture on Venice Oceanfront Walk, I stood there a couple days taking pictures, and so I have a lot of pictures to make things out of, different scenarios. So one of them is all about the color red. I had no idea that I was going to do something with the color red when I started taking the pictures. You know, I did notice that, oh, every time somebody came by with red, because the background is blue, you know, it's painted kind of bluish gray, that there was a contrast there. So in the thousands of pictures that I took on those couple of days, I had, I don't know, maybe 30 or more, or I don't know exactly how many pictures where there was red in the picture. So then I started looking at the red pictures and started editing them. And they go from a small amount of red in the number one picture which would be top left, and to the last picture where there's a fire engine in the picture, where it occupies a lot of space. and also a contrast of a person walking the other way to say as if, okay, we're going to start another sequence or the traffic is going to continue. But during those, I forgot, maybe 20 pictures in that series, you know, the red gets closer to the frame. Some people, I think there's a bicycle in there with somebody jumping. They might have red. Other people have red, you know. So it was just about the color red in that picture. There's another one that's just about the color bicycles, just about bicycles, not the color, but just people on bicycles. And that gets interesting. And then I try to put them in bicycles going the same direction, bicycles going, look like they're going to collide or maybe going in opposite directions or something. So there's always some kind of a theme that that in these paper movies, it could be a compositional theme or it could be a color scheme or a theme or a humorous theme. But I find that when I present them to people, some people get it and want to look at it and see, oh, there's something going on. Other people, because we're assailed with so many images every day, that they don't bother to look at them. So now I'm faced with the fact that, okay, some people are going to look at them, some people aren't going to look at them. When I want to show them to people or want people to pay attention to them, I often edit them out and take a single frame from that and post it, you know, or show it to somebody. So I try and take one that's provocative, or maybe I take two and juxtapose them together so that people can digest that and not look at the whole thing. There are people who like looking at the whole thing, but you know, it's just a problem that's ongoing and that I'm continuing to try and solve. And I think that you know, it's I guess I'm indulging myself, which I love to do.
Why not?
Right.
I'm just amazed at your patience to be in one place for so long. How do you do that? Or is that just in your DNA?
I don't think that I am patient about some things, but I'm as you can tell by the interview, that I'm a hyper person and have been for years. I don't drink coffee because I can't control myself if I do. So, but you know, like if I have a task at hand, then I just stick with it until I'm too tired to stand up or until I think I solved the problem. And I don't, you know, and I don't always solve the problem. And sometimes when I go back and look at the pictures and I see that, oh, wow, how come I didn't see this possibility? You know, then I have to go back and or at least I can learn from that realization or that discovery from what I missed in taking my pictures. You know, that's the wonderful thing about photography, is it lasts longer than the moment. So I may have missed it in the moment when I was there.
Sure.
But when I go back and see the image, which I can look at for a longer period of time, then I see, wow, I missed this, but it allows me to learn something and go back and do it. So do I, you know, I went to the high school that I went to in Cincinnati, the mascot was the Bulldogs, the Woodward Bulldogs. And I guess and at heart, I'm just, you know, like once I bite on, I just don't let go. So maybe that's where the patience comes from. But otherwise, you know, like I try and get as many things done at once. And I like standing out there because for me, it's a show. You know, I'm there, I'm a voyeur, and I'm looking at the show going by. I just also happen to be capturing it, you know, so it's, you know, it's a, I'm a voyeur and I'm also, you know, on a safari, and my prey are the people going by, and I get to capture them, and I capture them on, you know, I capture them digitally now, but before I captured them on film, and that's the reward for me. You know, I like to do that. And You know, that's that. I guess maybe that is part of my DNA. So happy to do that.
Yeah, that's really neat you're able to as well. So I guess you mentioned earlier you've got a show coming up in July.
I do, and it's of Jazz Images, but the Perfect Photo Gallery, I think he's become pretty interested in my other pictures too, and doesn't quite know, because I've been all over the place, as you can see from in my travel experience, that too, but just because I have so many interests that I keep trying to do different things using the medium of photography. I think he's become more, Alonzo's become more interested in other works too, and we haven't really talked about that, but I think that I happen to like that that particular gallery, because, you know, he's also trying to help, he supports causes, tries to get young people who might be wayward or might be, I guess, disenfranchised to be involved in photography. So he has some other values that I think we have in common. So I want to support that. And, if he winds up that he is interested in other photography, I would like for him to show that those other things too. Even though there are other galleries in Los Angeles that are higher end galleries, so to speak, that are also interested in my work, I don't think that they're as interested in me. I think that they're more interested in, well, how can I, who of my clientele can I sell this picture to? I think they're more interested in that than they are in the work itself, you know? And personally, I would rather go with somebody who realizes the worth of the work, you know? For instance, last week, Richard Moore, who is a dealer who sells my pictures when he can, and he's based in Oakland, sold 4 pictures of mine to the New York Public Library. Wow, was I stoked about that.
Yeah.
Because it's in a library, you know? That was really, you know, like that meant much more to me than somebody buying a picture to hang on the wall in their house. So,
yeah, well, a lot more people are going to see it.
Well, I think more people are going to see it, but you know, that just means that it's accessible, you know? And
yeah.
And I just felt, wow, a library, that felt really good to me. So,
yeah. And it's a really cool library too.
Yeah. Yeah. It is a cool library. That is it. You know, it made my day.
So the show at the gallery is called Perfect Exposure. Is that what
Yes. Yeah. Perfect Exposure Gallery.
And where is it? It's in LA.
It's in LA on in the Mid Wilshire District on 6th Street.
Okay, and so when's the show? You said late August, late July.
Well,
early
haven't set set the date, but he said late July or early August, and I need to set the date with him. I'm hoping this week, because on the end of May. I'm leaving here for a month. I got a residency in Rotterdam, Holland, for a month. They gave me a studio, a place to live, and a bicycle. And they did the same for my wife. So she's going there. She'll probably use the studio, which is a large studio, to create things, because she's a sculptor. But when I asked, is there any photo gear there, they said no. So I'll be out taking pictures on the street in Holland. And since we don't have to be there 24/7, there is an opportunity to travel and to see other museums and go to other cities. I'll be doing some work in other cities on the street also.
Yeah, what a great experience. Yeah, I think you said your wife just got a
Yeah,
Quite interesting award.
my wife just got a Guggenheim, which is incredible. I mean, that's really an affirmation for the work that she's been doing for years as a sculptor. And I think that being recognized as a sculptor is even more difficult than being recognized as a painter or as a multimedia artist, because you know, there are fewer sculptures, and people just don't have the place to put sculpture, and especially if they're large size. So, and she recently did a self-portrait that's a little bit different than what she had been doing in the past, because she had been mostly doing more abstract things. But she did a self-portrait that is 8'1".
Wow.
So, and it scares the hell out of me, because when I come down from my office into the studio, there I see a likeness of her that's twice my size. So, you know, especially if it's dark and it's night, or I quit working at midnight and I come down there and there's this big, big figure of her looming over me like, are you sure you didn't do anything wrong, Ave? So, you know, like it puts me in its place. So I'm thrilled for her. And I'm happy that she got that. And I think she's certainly been on cloud nine for a month now since she's known, although it was only announced last week, because you have to keep it under your hat until Guggenheim announces it. So she's just off to New York at the end of the week to pick up the award. So
that's wonderful. And she's the sculptor Phyllis Green, right?
Phyllis Green. Yes.
Yeah, congratulations to Phyllis.
Yeah, it's phyllisgreen.net.
Good. Well, that's my next question.
Yeah, that's how to reach her. And you know, before we finish this, and I'm certainly not pushing to do that, there are a lot of photographers who I would like to give a shout out to.
Oh yeah,
you know?
Great.
If that's, I mean, I'll keep it maybe to 10 or so. But I can say that aside from Ray Metzger, who I think is incredible, and Bresson, who I mentioned, you know, Eugene Ager, the French photographer, geez, you know, like I've seen his retrospective twice now. The last time I saw it was in Spain a couple years ago. What a wonderful photographer he is. And naturally, people like Brassai and Ouija was a really early influence of mine. I thought he was incredible, you know, especially on the humor side. And as Elliot Erwitt, who is also has a lot of humor in his photographs, and then Lee Friedlander, who I think has a lens implanted in his forehead, you know, because there isn't anything he won't take a picture of, and they're good. So, you know, my hat off to him. And Gary Winograd, who I knew briefly in Los Angeles, who was really a tortured guy. You know, he was not a very happy guy, but he had very bad eyesight, as I remember, but had a sixth sense. So he knew when something was going on and would just spin around and take a picture of that. That's why he has no, you know, his station points are all funny, and his I guess horizon lines are all wiggly or mm-hmm. on an angle, because that didn't matter to him. It was that he knew something was going on, and he could, I think he also belonged to the FA, school, so he didn't have to focus. He just spun around and took the picture, and he took a lot of really great pictures. So those are some of my old-time heroes, some of whom are still alive. And then, you know, like there are all those wonderful women photographers who don't get their due, you know, because everybody, when you say photographer, you know, like everybody always thinks that it's a man's game. So there are, you know, one of my really early influences certainly was Borg White, but I mean, that was a long time ago. But then, you know, like there was the Brava, the Mexican photographer, and Model, and then you know, like for the lyrical stuff, Dora Maar, and then Mary Ellen Mark was a hero of mine in a time when I was really developing as a photographer. I was saying, "Oh my God, this is a woman who is taking pictures that a subject matter that men would take pictures of, but she has an entree to this because she's a woman, you know." Mm-hmm. So she was disarming, you know, like she did the Falcon Road, which was the street in Bombay of prostitutes that a man would have been interested in, but never could have gotten in to take the pictures. You know, those are wonderful, incredible pictures, and all those wonderful circus pictures that she did. And she's just a really great photographer, Mary Ellen Mark. And then most recently, you know, I think everybody has discovered Vivian Meyer, mm-hmm. So who took pictures in Chicago, and she was recently discovered. So, you know, those pictures are really beautiful pictures. You know, she took them with a roller cord, a roller flex or a roller mm-hmm. cord, one of the first cameras that I ever used. So very deliberate pictures, and they're beautiful. So those women photographers, you know, like people should pay more, and there are a lot more, you know, people should pay more attention to women photographers. I think that they're really good too, you know, and, you know, they're in fact, there are so many good photographers that, you know, like I don't know them all. I could never name them all. There's all those wonderful Japanese photographers, French photographers, people from anybody who has a camera who's good. You know, the new guys, I really like Matt Stewart. He has a mm-hmm. lot of sense of humor. And I think that JR, I don't know what his name is JR, who posts these huge photographs of in slums of cities where he's taken the pictures. Those are incredible. What a great idea that is. Steve McCurry, who's a really good photographer. Those are all new guys. There's too many photographers to mention, and they're all doing good work. So I only, you know, they've all got my vote. You know, kudos to all those guys.
Yeah, I agree. There are just so many good people out there. It's intimidating.
Well, I don't look at them as competition.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I just I think that if you do that, you'll just you know, you'll drive yourself nuts. You know, that's probably not a good attitude. I mean, I go to a lot of openings and shows, you know, and look at the new work. And very often I say, oh, my God, this is so bad. How could they put this up on the wall? But I don't think it's ever about, I hate this person or they're my competition. I think it's mostly about the people who are. My disappointment is in the people who are looking at the work, not in the people who are doing the work. So, you know, or wondering why is this dealer showing this work, or who's buying this work, or, you know, some things I don't understand, or it's beyond me.
It's a good point. So tell us, where can people find you out there?
They can find me at avepildis.com or avepildisjazz.com. Which are both websites. I think on the websites, there might be a mention of, you know, like dealers. But if not, if people want to send me an email, and it's that's listed on the website, or it's avepildis@roadrunner.com. If they send me an email and are interested in the work, I can put them on a PixFix list, and then I'll send them a picture every week. I think that I can send it out to 500 people, but there are a lot of people who don't open my pictures. And if they don't do that for, you know, a couple months, then I drop them off the list and put somebody else on the list. And I love sending my pictures out. I love finding out who's opening them or who's following me. It gives me, it's a source of pleasure for me to track that people are looking at my pictures. And this is through a company, not a plug for the company, but it's through a company called Constant Contact. And the nice part about that is that I can track it. And you know, both send it out, and also, you know, they have an open rate, the industry standard open rate. This is a little, I'm going to have to brag a little bit here. The industry standard open rate is just under 20%. I think it's, they advertise that 19.2% of the people, you know, who send out things open them up. And whenever I call them with a problem or some help, they say, "Oh, you're the guy who has the highest open rate of a, you know." And I'm not selling anything on the site. I just want people to look at. On this post, I just want people to look at the pictures. So my open rate is between 55% and 60%. So that's more than half of the people that I send these things out to, look at the pictures. And I tried to get around the number of how many I could send out. So I have two lists. I have a list of fellow photographers and friends that I send things out, and they get one picture. And then the other list is for photo collectors, galleries, and editors. And then I send out a slightly different kind of picture to those people. Because those people don't want to see that, you know, like, oh, I had a good time in Thailand or in Southeast Asia or in Spain. You know, they want to see something that they consider to be art, which is a whole other subject. But sometimes the pictures are the same. So,
yeah, you put me on the list. I'll tell you what happened to me. I'd started using a service called SaneBox that supposedly sorts the unimportant from the important stuff. And I found two of your emails in there, and they never got into my inbox. So luckily I found them and opened them.
Oh.
So that happens a lot. You like Gmail will filter people's emails out.
It happens.
Yeah,
you know.
It does. But that's good. You know, you keep up on it. You keep your list clean with people who actually want your stuff, so you're going to have a high open rate.
Yeah, I really enjoy sending them out. It's always I send them out on Wednesday morning. This is the same time every week, and it's always challenging for me on Tuesday. That's today, because I have no idea on Monday or Tuesday morning what I'm going to send out. Huh. If I wake up in a particular mood or thinking about something, I look to see if I have that picture. If it's a holiday, I look to see if I have that picture. Or I just look through my files and say, oh, okay, I'll send this one out. So Tuesday, and that's probably what I'll do this afternoon, is I'll find a couple of pictures to send out.
That's good. Well, I look forward to seeing it in the morning.
Yeah, life is tough, isn't it?
Yeah, it's tough. It's tough. Down there in where are you, Marina Del Rey?
No, I'm in Santa Monica.
Oh, Santa Monica, okay. Yeah, like life is tough, man.
It's right always
by the ocean.
Always sunny here, you know. I built a solar house here, so my house is solar. That means that my electric bill for the year, I hate to tell this to everybody, but if you have a chance to go solar, do that. My electric bill for the year has, and it's been 15 years since I've had solar electricity. The most it's ever been is $250 for the entire year.
Wow, that's wonderful.
So, I know the electric. I know that Edison out here, who is my provider, hates me, and they charge me the $250 is because they charge me for storage and delivery. Because I put my electricity back on the grid. But mm-hmm. you know, there's no carbon footprint. You know, like I'm not, like burning any oil or coal to make the electricity. I mean, personally,
But, you know, it seems to be, you know, like even if you live in a climate where it doesn't have as much sun as California, it will supplement, you know, like your electric bill and help take care of the environment. So I can only encourage people to, you know, I might be around here for another 10 years, but I'd like the planet to be here for longer.
Yeah, so would the rest of us.
Yeah.
All right, Ave. Well, thank you very much. Appreciate you taking the time to talk.
It was a pleasure. I'm happy to meet you. I'd like to spend some more time with you sometime. The next time I get to Ohio, I hope that I can see you. But you're certainly welcome here if you want to come to California. We because people have always been good to me in my travels, you know, like we accept travelers here. And while up in the studio, we have a couch that folds into a double bed. You're always welcome to stay here.
Oh, that's wonderful. Yeah, we were just there. Well, we were there in September. And had I known you, I would have come up to see you.
Okay, well, you're welcome here.
Good.
And happy to stay in touch with you.
I will become the guest who wouldn't leave.
Oh.
No, just kidding. Just kidding.
That's happened but a few times, but we've managed to get them out somewhere or another.
Well, one way or another, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, it'll be Norbert. Norbert will get rid of them.
That's
the bird.
We leave the cover off of Norbert and put him close to the staircase. That generally does it.
All right. I'll remember that. Okay, well, thanks.
Okay, thank you, Bob. Nice to talk to you.
Same here.